Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Jen Polk is a career coach for professors, postdocs, and PhD students looking to make the jump from academia to industry. She got her PhD in history at the University of Toronto, and since 2013, she has guided students and faculty in identifying fulfilling opportunities that align with their goals and values through one-on-one coaching, group facilitation, and workshops, webinars, conferences, and through her written work, which has been published in various journals, books, and on her blog and business website, From PhD to Life. Topics discussed include history, career coaching, job searching, entrepreneurship, elevator pitches, networking, and LinkedIn. Links to Jen's LinkedIn, website, and other resources are in the show notes. And if you think you'd be a good guest on this show, or you'd like to recommend a linguist for me to interview, please fill out the contact form on the website at linguisticscareercast.com. My guest for today is Jen Polk, and Jen is a very special guest. She's not a linguist, but she is a person who has actually made a career out of doing the thing that the Linguistics Career Launch has been trying to do for several years, which is opening up careers for people outside academia. So Jen, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
I'm so excited. I love being an extra special guest. I think I added that extra there. Extra special guest.
Yeah. Even though this is the Linguistics Career Cast, we are open to all the social sciences and humanities. We are not prejudiced and just have linguists on. We've had anthropologists and psycholinguists and all sorts of people on. So thank you for talking with us. And what I want to do, I usually start off by asking people, how did you get interested in linguistics? But I'm not going to ask you that since you're not a linguist. How did you get interested in history, right? That was what you did your degree in, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What impelled you to actually get a PhD?
What impelled me to get a PhD? How far back should I go?
Well, what is relevant? Like what started you on that path to higher education?
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a family where I don't think there was ever a question that I wouldn't do a degree. I mean, I was always good at school, eldest daughter, you know, mm-hmm. You can fill in the blanks there. Actually, my dad has a undergrad in history as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I did my undergrad in European and Russian studies, which was a interdisciplinary kind of humanities / social science program. And then I was going to do a master's, and I had two options. I could do continuing Russian studies, or I could do a history PhD. Those are my options. And mm-hmm. The decision came down to, well, if you want to do a PhD after your master's, because in Canada, at least in humanities and social sciences, the vast majority of the time, you don't go straight into the PhD. You mm-hmm. have to do a master's first. Mm-hmm. So it was like, well, if you're going to do a PhD, you probably want to pick the discipline of history because that is a direct path. Anyways, so I ended up doing an MA in history, not a very good story. That was a 2-year program, and then I kept going mm-hmm. as people do, switched to a different university. I did a PhD also in history and finished that. When did I finish? 2012. This month, actually, in 2012, mm-hmm. it's February. I missed my defense anniversary date. It was 5 days ago. 14 years and 5 days. What have I been doing with my life since then?
And what did you think you were going to do with your PhD then?
It's a good question, because the answer is I wasn't thinking that. When I simply took the next step, because education is always a good thing. You know, I'm mm-hmm, not telling mm-hmm. you that that's true, but I'm saying that was the mindset. And getting another degree was always going to be a good thing. I had funding. I mean, it wasn't a lot, but it was enough to live on, you know, with a roommate, et cetera. And the goal was to simply do the thing and, you know, enjoy it. I don't know how common that is, but that back then that was where I came from. There was no what to do after was a pressing concern once I got going, but not mm-hmm. not when I was starting.
And then once you finished, did it hit you at some point where you were like, oh, now I have to do something?
Yeah, I had this moment of maybe a couple years after I started my PhD, I was at a department meeting and the grad reps would like sit around the edges of the room, like not saying anything. And the professors would talk amongst themselves, and the chair of the department like gave this report where she reported, and the takeaway message was that this was a good thing, but her message was that 50%, half of their PhD grads were getting jobs. I can't remember exactly, but I meant sort of real jobs, right? Mm-hmm. 50%. And I remember like thinking to myself, like, hot damn, half? And my takeaway was only half, because I didn't really have a sense back then. And this was literally 20 years ago. And of course, now we know, I mean, I'm assuming now the stats would be worse. But back then my takeaway was like, oh shit, this is a problem. I don't know that I'm gonna be in the top half. Now what? Well, now what? I mean, it wasn't gonna happen for a few more years in my case, but
it's interesting that they were tracking it, because a lot of departments don't even do that, right? People graduate and they just leave. And this is true in linguistics anyway. We have found that many departments don't keep track of what happens to people who leave, whether they get academic jobs or non-academic jobs. They're just gone. And when you ask them, they're like, oh, we don't know. Like, you should track them.
I mean, it's a good question. And actually, I don't know what the answer is. But if I had to take a guess, for what it's worth, I would say that was part of having to prove that they would continue to be accredited, or whatever the language that is. Like, sure. There were, you know, there's reviews. Like, are you still allowed to offer this major, this minor, whatever it is? So my assumption would be that they would have had to have had some and at least internal tracking of at least academic type posts, whether they continued to track and whether they cared about people who didn't show up in the list of people with faculty positions or postdocs. I suspect not, but anyways, that would be my guess, that there was some sort of selfish reason why they had to do that.
Sure. Yeah.
At least when it came to the academics.
And for your department, did they provide, like, what kind of support did they provide for students who were coming to the end of their degrees? You know, were there counselors, both on the academic side and on the non-academic side, who you could actually talk to and who could provide you with some kind of guidance or support in figuring out what you were going to do once you got your PhD?
Yeah. So just caveat to anyone listening, you know, if you look, I went to the University of Toronto, but yes, it was years and years ago now. So like, let's not, you know, just to be clear, I'm not talking about now. I actually don't know what's happening now. But back then in my memory, you know, really the person that you would lean on would be your primary advisor, maybe your secondary advisor, supervisors, we called them. You know, we had supervisors, we had other committee members. Maybe we would interact with other professors, depending, and then other people in the program, maybe recent grads if you were as part of that network. There was certainly no like staff member who knew anything about jobs. I think there was like a staff member who was tasked with like job market stuff, but of course, like we all understood that was an academic job market stuff. So that was the person who would, you know, book a suite at the AHA. Anyways, blah, 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 blah. As it turned out, didn't have a lot to discuss with that person. So to make a long story short, when I finished, I actually never ended up going on the academic job market. I defended in February. And if I think folks who know the academic market, at least back then, it was, maybe it's a little muddier now, but back then, like the season was over, you know, the people were already getting offers. Right. And since I hadn't been on the market like that fall, I'd missed my chance. And so it was always like, well, I can go on the market, you know, next fall. And I never ended up doing that. I never ended up applying for anything. Not because I had a better idea, but because I could not imagine myself getting hired or being happy if I did manage to get myself hired. And those mm-hmm. two are quite different statements, but both existed at the same time for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you come to the realization that you didn't want to be in academia? Was it like a sudden thing, or was it just kind of a growing feeling like, oh, this environment is not quite right for me?
Yeah, I think gradual is more correct. Let me think. I mean, you know, one of the things that I experienced is when I started my PhD, it was very gung-ho. I was really excited about it. I was excited about my supervisor. I was excited. We had a big cohort. There was like, I don't know, 25 of us or something like that, you know, across various subfields. That's the right terminology here in history. And, you know, no one else was in my specific like subfield, but yeah, it was like, it was kind of exciting. It was fun. Mm-hmm. I was young. I'd moved to the big city, like Toronto. And I was very involved in the department, you know, grad student stuff. But then I, you know, as the years go by, felt quite disconnected. You know, I ended up feeling quite disconnected and not really part of that community. And then that was part of the disillusionment for me. And it's not that it was necessarily anybody's fault, but it becomes harder. You know, at least for me, I think it was part of it being more challenging for me to imagine a happiness in this culture that I just felt disconnected with. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, ended up not really ever finding my way back in, except to be in community with the other disaffected.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, hello. Nice to meet you, Laurel.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, for me, the thing that really tipped the scales was that I hated teaching.
Mm.
And it wasn't that I hated teaching as a concept. So the first couple of classes that I taught, I really enjoyed it. I was like, ooh, this is fun. I like getting up in front of people and, you know, teaching a class. And I was pretty good at it. Like, I wasn't a natural teacher, but I think I did a good job. But once I had taught the same class like 4 times in a row, I hated it. Just doing the same material over and over again. And I could not figure out how to make it interesting to me. and you know, like, but you have to, right? Like, you can't be bored in front of your students. No. You can't be bored with it as a teacher. And so I have the utmost respect for teachers who are able to take the same material and teach it semester after semester with different students and still be interested and make it interesting and make it fun and all that. I just cannot do that. I do not have that talent. So I knew that there was no way I could have a career and have that be one of my responsibilities for what, like 20 or 30 years. I just couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I think anyways, I'm veering off on tangents here. Next.
Tangents are great. No, tangents are very interesting. And we find things on tangents that we don't expect to. So that's totally cool. So you made a decision that you weren't going to be an academic. What did you do after that?
Yeah. So I'm sighing. Yeah. Because, and I said this before, it's not that I had a better idea. And so what did I end up doing?
You didn't have an idea, but you had to do something. And
you know,
and
you got to figure this shit out, right? Figure this shit out. A person has to make income or has to sort of be moving toward making income, right? I mean, most of us, right? Most of us. So the immediate way that I made income was I freelanced. And so, you know, I had a variety of projects. None of this stuff sort of really related to what I do now. And none of it was really related to, you know, my PhD in any way, but just by having lived in Toronto for so many years. And I got connected with folks just to do stuff. And that was great for you know, as a temporary stopgap. Then I started to pick up on things like, oh, you should be doing informational interviews, and oh, career coaching exists as a thing, and oh, Twitter, oh, academic Twitter, oh, we're having conversations about alt-ac, alternative academics, and, you know, we're right, so getting involved in those discussions. And the thing that really shifted things for me was I ended up hiring a career coach. This is Hillary Hutchinson. She still works. She's still around. You still hire her. She works, one of her main areas of practice is with unhappy academics, as she called it. And that it was, I'm not exaggerating when I say this. You know, working with Hillary was really life-changing for me because I had never interacted with somebody in the way that she interacted with me, which is starting from the assumption that I was exactly in the right place where I needed to be, that my story was familiar to her, not in the details, but right, that this was a pattern, a trend, that I was, you know, I was in community with people that I didn't know but did exist, and that there were things that I could do to move myself forward. And, you know, fast forward a few months and I ended up taking a course in how to coach, so learning coaching skills. And it was in the context of that first course that I took that I ended up, without intending to, I ended up starting my business, helping people who, you know, as I put it back then, were like a step or two behind me. So I was not positioning myself as any kind of super expert here, but it's like, okay, I'm a step ahead of you. Just like when you're in the classroom with your undergrads, right? You know, all you really need to be, the minimum viable is like, you are one chapter ahead in the textbook as them, right? Of them. And that was back in 2013. And you know, things have changed over the years, but I'm still basically focused on the same thing, which is, what do you do after a PhD, especially if it's not going to be working as a faculty member long term?
Well, it's so cool that you've created, I will say, a career out of doing this. It seems like it is such a need, like, that there could be a lot of people. Well, Are there a lot of people who have a career doing this? It seems like there's a need for this.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I think is important. Well, one thing that I think about a lot is there is a big difference between a need for a thing and whether you can make money offering that thing. I mean, I suspect that you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So there's definitely a need for this kind of work, and there are. And there are some of us who do this, but I'm definitely one of the folks that has been around the longest, and I'm still doing this. You know, the specifics of that have changed, but I'm still here, like, what, 12 and a half years later or something. I'm still here.
Yeah. So what kind of people are your clients? I'm assuming that they come from many different areas of academia. You know, do they tend to come more from the humanities or social sciences, or do they come from the hard sciences, or is it all over the place?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked this because it's really interesting. You know, when the first few years when I was doing this, and I think it's in part because of the people that I was interacting with a lot. I think there was an assumption that most of my clients were grad students. And, you know, if you take a step past that, I think people would get mad at me for charging money to students. But the reality is, and this has always been the case, is that many of my students are, in fact, professors, postdocs, some recent PhDs. But increasingly, the majority of my clients are folks that are beyond grad school.
Right.
And, it's not something that I expected, but of course, it just makes sense to me now. From what backgrounds do they come in terms of academic discipline? Yeah, all over the place. It's one of the things that I'm really excited about always, is that even though I myself have a background in history and the humanities, and I think some folks in the humanities therefore find affinity with me, because we are we are a smaller group than other groups. I've always had the majority, I think is true, of my clients have been from STEM simply because they are the majority.
Yeah.
But yeah, I've really always had the vast, you know, all of the above have been my clients, and I've really appreciated that. It's always, yeah, it's been really fun. We got a lot in common. We got some differences. And it's, yeah, it's been fun to play around in that.
I was just thinking about what you said, that they, many of your clients seem to be people maybe who have tried to make it in academia and figured out that wasn't going to work. Would that be correct?
Yes. And the not, this isn't going to work piece is it, what am I trying to say here? Like, it's, yes, very occasionally it's because you didn't get tenure and you're going to lose your job. Like, sure. But it is common for it to be not a crisis like that and more of, you know, this is cool. I like this, but I want different. I want to live somewhere different. I want to have a different like arrangement of things that I do during my day. I'm bored there's such a variety in terms of what draws people to other types of careers and pushes people away from the career path they're in. And so just to, you know, in case people are imagining, well, Jen works with the losers. I mean, no, I mean, that's, you know, I say that in jest, but that's not it. You know, even though I can speak from experience, maybe some of us do feel like losers sometimes. I think.
Well, I'm glad. I am so glad you brought that up, because listeners to this podcast will know that this is one of my things that I get on the soapbox about pretty frequently,
which is
that there has been in the past, and there's less of it now, but it still continues, the feeling from academia that if you don't make it in academia, it's your fault. That's bullshit, right? You know, it is not your fault because there's no fucking jobs. And you can do nothing about that. If there are no jobs and you don't get a job, it's not your fault. What are you supposed to do? Like, it's an impossible situation to be in. You can be the best of the best, and if there's no job, you can't get a job, and therefore it is not your fault. And you also have to take into account all the structural inequalities that exist in academia, which is another reason why you're probably not going to get a job. So I am very just righteously angry about this culture of shame about, you know, putting it all on you, the person who didn't get a job in academia or didn't get a scholarship or didn't get a postdoc, that it was your fault that you did it, because it happened to me and it's happened to other people where you got the O2 bad for whatever, for not finishing your degree or not getting that postdoc or whatever, you know, when it wasn't your fault in so many ways. And yet there was the shame and the pity and the, you're not good enough. And it, on top of the thing that you didn't get, which was bad enough, and you know, you're now, your life has changed because you thought you were going to get a job and you didn't. Now you have to put up with this pity and shame from other people that it was your fault that you didn't get it when it wasn't.
Yeah.
And that's just awful. Like, you shouldn't have to live with that.
Totally. And I don't know if it's relevant to talk about this here, but it's on my mind. I mean, I've recently, like in the last like few weeks, I've had a couple of extended conversations with folks who, so two different people who have gotten and turned down tenure track job offers. And, you know, it's, I kind of love that, you know?
I kind of love that.
I mean, I hope people don't take this the wrong way, because yeah, obviously for many of us, getting a job is like not a possibility, right? I mean, as you were saying, like, it's just like nothing to do with you. It's simply not a possibility in the world as it exists. But if you are getting offers and you turn them down, like, I love that, because I think that demonstrates knowing what you want and what you're mm-hmm. about, and being mm-hmm. able to make an evaluation of what is being sure. offered to you and saying, yeah, nope, I can do better. Yeah. I can do better. And it doesn't, at least for these two people, and honestly, probably for everyone, it doesn't come from a place of, well, you're not Harvard. Because actually some of these people got quite, it's pretty impressive, some of these offers, in terms of what is impressive from an academic standpoint. But the folks I'm talking to are prioritizing what they care about. And sure. that, I guess that's my point, right? That's what yeah. I really embrace, is like, let's privilege what we care about, what you mm-hmm. care about, not, it doesn't matter what your advisor, your mentor, your supervisor thinks, your chair, like that. What matters is what's important to you mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and the people you care about.
Right, which is a very different point of view than what we have been told throughout our academic lives, which is that it doesn't matter what your priorities are, right? You should take what's being offered to you, because you'll probably never, ever get another offer like this in your life. And your job is to just suck it up and
yes.
go yeah. wherever you're assigned, as if you were, you know, a ensign in the army or something like that. Yes. It's like, this is what you do, and it doesn't totally. Matter. Totally. You don't really matter. You're supposed to do this stuff.
Totally. Like it's not that I ever did. I never applied. I never got an offer, but I felt like an asshole for not applying for academic jobs, because I felt like it was the thing that I should be doing. It's the
your
thing
duty.
That I kind
it
of
was your
it
duty.
Was my, yeah, it was my duty. I mean, I might not have said it in exactly that way, but it was what I was supposed to be doing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? It was the end, and I felt guilty. I felt bad.
Yeah.
For choosing not to. I think it, in my case, it was less of a choosing not to and more of a I couldn't make myself do it.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm happy with the I'm choosing otherwise.
Yeah. 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 I think that is all exactly correct. It's such a weird culture, academia, that by joining it, there's parts of it that exist to take away your choice and your autonomy.
Mm.
And you sort of go along with it because that is the way it's supposed to be. I don't know. It's very strange. It is strange
because it's like you join this thing that gives you supposedly all of this intellectual creative freedom,
mm-hmm.
right? This is you're being sold in part. And then the further along you get, the closer you get to that, you know, goal, the more your options are constrained,
mm-hmm.
the more you lose yourself, you become, yeah, maybe you're the world's expert in X, but you have lost completely yourself.
Yeah. I think the thing that is diabolical about it in a way is that you do see people, tenure track professors, for whom all of that is true. Like, they do have the freedom to pursue their passions, and, you know, they take sabbaticals and they write books and they're able to spend all their time doing what they want and pursuing things that they are incredibly passionate about, and you're like, yeah, man, that's amazing. Like, they do all this stuff and you're like, I want that. And you're trying to figure out how to get what they have, and I don't know, it's always a little bit out of reach for you. Not for them, for you.
You know, I always wonder, I mean, I think that those folks, as you describe them, definitely exist, but I think there's fewer and fewer of them.
I agree. I totally yeah. agree. I think it's a generational thing that yeah. it was possible for a while.
Yeah.
I don't see many people like that now. I was specifically thinking of my time at Berkeley, the professors who were teaching me when I was there. So I was there in the 90s. And so these people would have gotten their education in the 60s.
Yeah.
And it was different. It was very different then.
Yeah.
So they were able to do that then. Don't think it's possible for that to happen now. Not at all.
And even if it looks on the surface like things are like that, I mean, I just remember when I was doing my PhD, one of my like committee members, you know, I realized at a certain point that he had spent decades married to the same person, but they lived in different cities and not adjoining cities. Right. They had they had two houses from this relationship because they were both professors. And I was, you know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know, but like, okay, that's not a feature, a common feature of like people with different types of careers.
So it is a very it is a culture unto itself, and you got to buy into all this stuff and just go, well, that's the way it is, I guess.
And is this really the dream job? I don't know. I question that.
So anyway, so I want to let's talk more about what you do with your coaching. So if someone comes to you and they say, and they're let's say that they are in a postdoc and they're not liking it, they're bored, they want to do something else. What do you offer them? What do they get from you if they sign up with you?
Yeah. So the main way that folks work with me is by joining my program. I have a, it's called the PhD Career Clarity Program, and it's a, you know, you can join anytime. It's a self-paced, the core of it is a self-paced online course. So it doesn't matter where in the world you are, what time zone you're in, all of that. And that is, okay, the purpose of my work with clients is typically to help them figure out what it is that they actually want to do next. People often come to me with this vague, they don't realize it's vague, but I know it's vague, notion of, great, so I want to pivot to industry. And, you know, followed maybe by, can you read my resume? And my first, you know, question to them, you know, as appropriate, is define industry, right? Like, what exactly are we talking about here? And that is where people often realize, like, oh, I actually am not super clear on that. And then, you know, hopefully they realize, and that's actually a problem for me. And so getting more clarity around what exactly it is that you want to do, and that what you want to do is not the same as what you can do. Right. But what do you actually want to do? And that is really what I would emphasize for people, is start there. Like, what do you actually want to do? What do you value? What's important to you? What are your priorities? You know, where do you want to live? Anyways, blah, 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 blah. Start there. And then you can say, okay, who hires for this? What is it called? You know, what kinds of people do this sort of thing for a living? Because often people take a totally different approach, which is, I have a PhD in X, internet gods, what jobs are right for me? Okay, ChatGPT, rewrite my CV into a resume. But they skip entirely the step of, okay, but what do I actually want to do? What do I care about? Anyway, so in my program, I take folks through that process. And I love the program because it allows me an opportunity to do small group coaching, which is my favorite, small group coaching and workshops with clients. It's totally optional, but I always recommend it. It's fun. It's fun to see people kind of maybe slow down in a way and really think about what's important to them before they start. Before they launch into a job search for real. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that sounds really great. So some of it is one-on-one and some of it can be group if you decide to participate in the group.
So for the program, one-on-one is not included, but certainly I offer, you know, that is a service that I offer separate from the program.
And so a lot of it sounds like is based around a little bit of therapy.
I always have to caveat this with, I'm not a therapist.
You're not a therapist.
I know that we're not doing that, but
it's like career therapy. You know, I mean, all those questions that you were saying, like what do you want and what do you want to do? Those are sort of therapy questions, like looking inside to figure out what it is that you want to do. But so part of it is, you know, self-reflection. So thinking about what you want, and as opposed to the practical stuff, I mean, you mentioned it, like working on your resume, that's sort of like the checklist stuff, do this, do this, do this. But part of it is really the self-reflection part too, just figuring out what is actually going to make you happy and where you can thrive in a career. So it's a combination of those two things.
Yeah. And kind of... I'm sighing because it's kind of annoying, but you can't outsource this. No one can do that work for you in terms of figuring out what it is that you, what lights you up.
Yeah.
Only you can do that. Other people can help by, you know, reminding you of experiences, by reflecting back what you said, by offering to listen and shut up.
But, yeah.
You know, only you can say, okay, but what is important to me? What do I actually want? What are my priorities here? What do I, you know, if I'm being honest with myself, what can I leave behind? Mm-hmm. That's on you to figure out.
Yeah. It sounds really rich. Do you give people like homework to do too?
Yes, there's always homework. I mean, of course, everyone's a grown up, so.
Well, I'm just speculating only because obviously you're dealing with a bunch of academics, and you know, what do we love? We love getting homework, and we love being graded on our homework and getting little gold stars and going, you did good. You got a good grade in therapy this week. Like, yeah, awesome. I love it.
So good thing for me is I'm not grading anything, So that's great. But yeah, there's yes. I mean, the point is, the point, of course, is not to make me, Jen, happy. The point is for you to take action, meaningful action that moves you closer to reaching your goals. So it's reflection is great, but then what are you doing next? Right? Yeah. What is the action? What did you learn? Okay, what's next? And that's always the goal in a coaching kind of situation is, yes, reflection, but it's not endless rumination. It's reflection so that you can take you the next step.
And then how do you, like, what are the practical things that you can help moving things forward? So working on resume, networking, emails, things like that?
Yeah. So every person is going to have a slightly or maybe very different job search process. Let me clarify. Application process, let's say. The application process is going to be a little bit different for everybody because applying for work in data science is not the same as applying for work as a high school teacher. It's not the same as launching your own business as a consultant, right? And then et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But in terms of kind of common overlaps for folks, it's yes, like what it, you know, doing those self-reflection activities is certainly something that I want everybody to be doing. Networking is part of it. But when in the initial stages, the kind of networking that you're doing is learning. So you're doing informational interviews and of course other types of learning as well. But I think it's really, really crucial for folks to do at least a handful of informational interviews. And the purpose of those is to learn from people who know, who actually know shit that's important to you, for you to find out, to gather those insights and that information so that you can make better decisions going forward. So I talk a lot with program folks about informational interviews and then networking more generally. And then if you are in a position where you have to put together formal application packages, which, you know, is very common. We can cover all of that. I think one of the key themes of my program and the conversations I have with members, with clients is first, like how to clarify what it is that you want and to describe it in your own words. And then to be able to communicate that effectively to others. And, you know, as you know, as a linguist, you know, learning what is important to the reader, the listener, you know, what is going to compel other people about your story. That's such a key part of it. Mm-hmm. So we talk a lot about communication and storytelling bringing up evidence. And yeah, it's very... In a way, it's creative, intellectual, academic type stuff.
Oh, sure. From a different angle. It really is. I think for linguists, it's part of what you learned how to do as a linguist. You're just applying it in a different way, but it can be difficult because there's a tendency to want to throw in with the jargon that you learned as a linguist, which is so off-putting to people because, you know, there's a part of you that wants to be super precise about the words and people are like, what are you talking about? I don't understand what these words mean. You're like, oh, that's right. I'm not talking to another linguist. I have to use real actual English words and not the jargon that I learned to describe this. And, I do that still sometimes when I'm talking to people. I will want to use the one precise word that I know describes what this thing is, but and then I have to remind myself, no, people don't know this word. Like, use a regular word. Use a normal word instead.
I have this this exercise I like to make people do in workshops, which is to write or say, you know, come up with a introduction for yourself, or at least the beginnings of an introduction for yourself, where you cannot reference your degree or your job title. I don't want to hear professor. I don't want to hear PhD. I don't want to hear postdoc. You cannot reference your discipline, right? Your subject matter. I don't want to hear linguistics. I don't want to hear chemistry, whatever, physics, etc. And you also cannot talk about your subfield or your particular dissertation topic. I don't want to hear anything about protein structures or blah, blah, blah. So what are you left with, right? Well, you know how? I'm the person in the room how. It who, right? Or in any situation where whatever, right? So I love that kind of exercise where that becomes the first or second, you know, sentences that you have to use before you're allowed, before I allow you, at least for the purposes for this exercise, before I allow you to drop in that academic stuff. People like that, you know, it might take them a minute to wrap their minds around what the purpose of this is, but it gets at like, what makes you like move in the world?
Yeah. Oh, it's really good. We used to, when I started doing the job that I do, which is naming things, my partners and I would sometimes challenge each other to say, okay, you have to explain what you do for a living, naming things, to somebody's mother in an elevator. And it's like, okay, do it without using all the technical terms that we would use in the business that we did. And you only have like, you know, 20 seconds to do it to someone's mom. And it was good because it really made you do it in a very, very simple way in a very short period of time. So it was similar in that way. Yeah. And sometimes that's the way you have to talk to CEOs of companies.
Yeah.
Interestingly.
And it's, I mean, I think, you know, you and I understand each other, but just to clarify in case others are kind of raising their eyebrows at us, it's not about talking down to anybody.
No, not at all.
It's not about assuming that other people are like, that don't get it. It's about inviting everybody in. It's about, you know, extending that invitation to everybody to, you know, be excited about the kind of change that you make in the world.
And for me, it always feels like I'm also trying to do a little bit of education too, because if you make it interesting, then you want them to ask you questions and to say, oh, is that what you do? Oh, tell me more. Like that's always the response that I am looking for from people is for them to go, oh, yes, I want to hear more about that. So that's how I'm always trying to frame what I'm saying is to get the tell me more response.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's the good one. So do you spend a lot of time talking about LinkedIn? This is a very sore subject with people who are entering the workforce.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. So LinkedIn is not essential. I just to say, like, I don't think you have to be on LinkedIn. But I do think LinkedIn is a valuable place, a useful place. And it is. There's different ways that it can be useful, but one of the ways that I think it can be very useful is as a place to find other people. And then what you do when you find those other people and the ways in which finding those people is useful to you, I mean, that depends. But it is a big imperfect, but it's a big imperfect database of professionals. And there's some value in being able to find those folks. Other things like, you know, what exactly is what exactly do you put on your LinkedIn profile in the different sections? You know, how much do you need to, quote, optimize it, unquote? You know, interacting with recruiters, do keywords matter? Like, what, no, skills section? I mean, whatever, do recommendations? Mm-hmm. Like, do you have to post? What about comment? Like, all of those other stuff for sure comes up. But yeah, at its core, I would say LinkedIn is a useful place to be and to be found and to find others. And the details will depend on you.
Yeah. I think the Linguistics Career Launch folks, we recommend putting yourself on LinkedIn because it's a good way to find people who you can do informational interviews with, sure, which is really good.
Definitely.
And also just to sort of vet people who might want to get in touch with you or that you might want to tap for something, even if it's not an informational interview, but just to see who maybe will work at a company where you're thinking of going or who might have some information that you need. And I've certainly used it for those reasons too, when I've been looking for like linguistic informants or sometimes people to have on the podcast, just looking around. So I agree with you. I don't think it's necessary, but it is important. It's too bad that it's really become lately a cesspool of like a lot of AI garbage and people posting a lot of irrelevant stuff. So it requires a lot of careful curation in the same way that Facebook does, I guess, to just use it for very specific things.
Yeah. What I've told my clients many times at this point is if we're all going to be on LinkedIn making money for billionaires, we might as well make it useful for ourselves and the people we care about. So if that means helping someone you know connect with somebody else that you know so that they can, you know, be in touch with each other. And if that takes you an extra 5 minutes out of your life, you know, that might be worth doing so that we're not just hanging out there so that Reid Hoffman can get rich or whatever.
No, for real. Definitely. And I think it, you know, my experience has been that it's a nice way to provide some reciprocal love to people that you've met during the course of your career that you want to stay in touch with by simply liking things that they post. That's nice. You know, it's people that, you know, we don't go to physical meetings anymore. You never see people anymore. And it's a nice way to stay in touch in that way. And sometimes you find that your paths will cross again. And it's just a pleasant way to say, hey, I remember you and we got along and I like you.
Yeah.
So there's that part of it.
I hope it's, I'm not up to date. I hope it still exists in the way I'm imagining it, but the recommendations feature, that section, I really like that because, you know, I remember somebody that worked with me a few years back, many years back now, but she reached out a few years ago and said, you know, would you write me a recommendation? And, you know, because I know myself, I was like, okay, well, let's get on Zoom together because I'm not doing this left to my own devices, but I absolutely want to. And it was just really fun, you know, to spend a few minutes kind of hearing from her, you know, how she saw the value of this recommendation potentially in her career going forward. And, you know, what she saw as things that she would want to highlight and me remembering. And it's sort of, I wrote it, but it's sort of with her watching. Sure. And it was, you know, I still remember it as like a good thing. So, you know, I think if you want to spend your time on LinkedIn doing meaningful things like that, that could be meaningful for you and the other person and might help somebody, you know, move the needle in their career search. That would be great.
Yeah, I totally agree. So we've now talked about different aspects of the services that you get. What is realistic for people to expect if they sign up for, you know, taking courses from you? Like what do they get at the end of this?
Yeah. I mean, so a thing that is very, I think it is reasonable to expect to get out of, you know, so let's say joining my program is much, much greater clarity around what it is that you actually want and what it takes to get there. Mm-hmm. The program as it exists right now you pay for it and it's 6 months. And that means, it doesn't mean that it takes you 6 months to do it, because it's, you know, 5 hours of online courses plus however many, you know, recorded workshops and however many, you know, live small group coaching session, whatever. But just to say, that's how long you have access for. Yeah. So by the time those 6 months are up, given the nature of the job market, I'm not promising things I have no control over, you know, whether you'll have a job offer or have started a new job. I, again, can't control that. But I think if you kind of show up and do the work that you need to do as laid out, that you can, feel much more confident and clear about where you're at and where you're headed and be on your way to getting there. In terms of taking action, you know, when I say on your way, that's what I mean, you know, doing informational interviews and writing those resumes. I mean, whatever else. And also that, you know, if you choose to, that you can be part of a really amazing community during those live meetings that we've got. And you can deepen your thinking in ways that you might not have realized would be so fun and interesting and useful. To brush up on your job search skills, but also, you know, what you know about yourself can be. Anyways, I'm veering, but yes, does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And do you have a lot of success stories? I mean, like the departments, do you track your successes from the program?
So I don't track them formally. I mean, that is a feature of, let's say, folks that run programs out of career centers, for example. I mean, you know, it's a condition of their being able to get funding and staff members to continue to exist. And I don't make people, I could not make people fill out surveys even if I wanted to, right?
Sure.
You know, I'm not doing social science research on my clients. And it's up to folks whether they want to share with me or not. But yeah, I have a sense that folks are definitely, you know, figuring out much more clearly what they want. You know, my kind of secret favorite thing is when somebody pivots in a completely different, surprising kind of way. I love that. But I will also say that my program is also one that can sit with you, and like the work that you do in it can sit with you. And even if it takes a couple of jobs over a few years to get there, that it will have value. And I think if I go on LinkedIn and sort of come across my clients that I've had over the years, I'll find them in all sorts of different surprising places. And that, I love that.
Yeah. Well, I'm looking at your website right now. The website is fromphdtolife.com. And the testimonials are great. I mean, people seem extremely satisfied, very happy with their experiences, which seems amazing.
One thing I'll flag for folks, flag in a good way, green flag. folks, go to my website. Exactly as you said, it's from phdtolife.com. You'll find there's a free webinar. So you can sign up to watch. Just give me your email address and you can watch my free webinar. It's a great resource. I've, you know, thousands of people have, you know, watched it and given me great feedback on that. It does include a sales pitch at the end, but please, I highly recommend watching it, because it will lay out exactly what I teach my clients in terms of what you should be doing, you know, step by step in order to get this clarity for yourself and what actions to take to move yourself forward in a sustainable way so that you actually do move forward and you don't have to be stuck anymore.
Yeah. You know, I've talked about this with other folks that we've had on the show, and I think one of the reasons that I wanted to have you on was because what your services really show is that looking for a job is a job. And it, you know, for PhDs especially, or master's degrees as well, even for having a bachelor's, you know, it's not just the way it used to be where it's like, fill out you do your resume, you send it in, fill out an application. It's not like that anymore. It's such a different world of getting the job that you want. As you said, when you do all that prep work and you're like, okay, this is what I want to do, this is where I want to be, there's so much work that goes into it. There's so much reflection. There's so much prep work that you have to do. There's so much crafting that goes into your resume, depending on the job that you're applying for. It's really hard to do all that stuff by yourself.
Yeah.
And, you know, most departments, I know there are some, especially in linguistics, like the Georgetown program is terrific, and some other departments do a pretty good job of preparing their students. You know, there are career counseling departments within the universities that help, but most linguistic departments are really shit at helping you do this kind of stuff. What are you going to do? Like, doing it all on your own is really, really tough. So to know that there are people and programs that can actually help you do this, I think, is just invaluable. And if you've got the money to pay for it, something like this can really kind of supercharge your entry into the job market.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
You know, people should take advantage of it if they can. And the Linguistics Career Launch provides a sum of this, you know, a portion of this as best we can, but it's not anything compared to the kind of attention and, you know, really focused work that you're going to be doing in a program like this.
Yeah. I mean, and I think I run the risk of overwhelming people. And so I say that knowing that that is a risk that I run. circular logic here. But there can be a lot to learn and a lot to practice at this. And so I say that as, if it feels like a lot, well, yeah, you're not wrong, but there is support for it. There is support for it. And my program is an example of a place where you can get that kind of support and then take things one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, when I run the risk of overwhelming people, you know, one thing that comes to mind is I've got now a library of like 25 different workshops, and they complement the core offer. But depending on your job search and the direction that you take it in, there's a lot potentially to think about and to learn and to do. And it's really great for me to be involved in helping people do that hard work in a way that is fun. Interesting and in community with others, and to be a resource for people for the times that they need it. And you know, those workshops are all optional because everyone's job search is different, but basically at its core, it's what do you want? What do you want to do? What's important to you? Step one, step two. Okay. What is that called? You know, who pays for that?
Yep.
Read those job ads, do some informational interviews. And then, okay, now you know what you want. You've narrowed it down. You understand what it's called, who hires for it. Now, what is the best job search active job application strategy? That's what I mean. What is the best active job application strategy for the exact type of job that you're aiming for? And then to come up with that strategy that is right for you and follow it, and adjusting things as you need to along the way.
Yep, it sounds amazing. I wish that there had been this sort of stuff back when I was looking for a job, because it definitely would have helped me. I mean, I fell into the job that I got, and I was completely unprepared for doing it and for working through it. And I was really lucky that my coworkers, who I eventually ended up starting my own company with, were MBAs.
Yeah.
So, you know, like, just so lucky that they actually understood stuff about this, because I knew nothing. I was an idiot. Like, I knew linguistics and that was pretty much it. And, you know, I was first generation going to college too, so I didn't know anything about anything. So
it's really interesting that you mentioned, you know, that experience. And I'm going to pivot that, but it's related, I promise, to say that, you know, one of the things I think people don't expect about my work is that a lot of my clients are folks that have already left academia and gotten different jobs. But they're back in a way, because with me, because they had to figure something else out, right? I mean, you can't just not have a job. But where they landed is not where they want to stay. That's a very common story. And I love working with those people, because it's like, okay, you basically understand how to get a job. You've done this. Let's press pause and figure out what is the next right thing.
Absolutely. Yeah. So valuable. This has been really great. And before we wrap up, I also want to just put in a quick plug. On this podcast, we have also talked to Anna Marie Trester, who runs a Career Linguist, which is the very linguistic focus career counseling stuff. She offers a sort of a not as broad a program as you do, but I just wanted to mention that to people. She's also written a book, so you can buy her book if that's the kind of career counseling that you're looking for. So
love
now
Anne
I know.
Marie.
Yeah,
her.
She's great.
Pay her money.
I know two people who do this kind of career counseling that's available for linguists, you and her. That's great. So two is better than none.
Two is better than none.
Yeah, it's really great. And her site is at careerlinguist.com, and I'll put that link in the notes.
Yeah, and her program is called Career Camp.
Career Camp is awesome. It's very relaxed. She's very she's really focused on storytelling, which I think is great. Like, that's her forte, and she's terrific at drawing out some of the stuff that you were talking about too, like, you know, figuring out how you want to present your skills in a way that other people can understand it. So yeah, it's great. So I am going to put all of your contact information in the show notes so that people can get in touch with you. I will put your LinkedIn profile in there too. How would you prefer that people get in touch with you? Email, LinkedIn, website? What do you want?
Yeah, all those are fine, okay. Laurel. I mean, people can reach out whatever is most convenient for them. I would give one caution. I still do have my ex account, but I pretend it doesn't exist.
Yeah. Yes. Toxic. Don't go on X. No good. No. No.
Oh, lament. I lament the Twitter.
Yeah, too bad. Twitter. It was fun. It was really fun when it was good.
It was good. It was good, yeah. But it doesn't exist anymore. So sad.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for talking with me today. This has been great. And maybe we'll have you on again one day when things are better, because that would be awesome.
Love it.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.